This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
If it's good policy, if people like it, if the American population thinks that that's the right thing to do, it will survive, you know, regardless.
It's not going to survive based on whether it's good policy. It's going to be subject to a political process that is substance free to an unfortunately large degree.
4.5 trillion dollars. That, give or take a few hundred billion, that is the number that President Joe Biden has proposed to get America moving forward. He's calling it the Build Back Better plan. Well, that is the idea. A gigantic amount of spending that is ambitious or aggressive or aspirational or reckless, depending on your perspective and depending on what you believe that kind of money should be spent on and on where that kind of money should come from. Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. Let's spend that money. Or not? I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared with another episode of Agree to Disagree, the program where smart people with opposing viewpoints meet in conversation. And for this one, I'm sitting down with Mark Zandi and Michael Strain. Mark, you are taking the yes position. You support the Build Back Better plan. You're also the chief economist for Moody's Analytics. You have debated with us on stage, in person, in front of live audiences before. So welcome back in this format. It's great to have you back.
Thanks, John. It's good to be with you. I miss those live events, though. They are a boatload of fun. Hopefully, you can get back to that soon.
A boatload is exactly what they are, and we will be back to them someday. Michael Strain, you're a senior fellow economist at the American Enterprise Institute. I want to say welcome to Intelligence Squared for the first time. Welcome into the boat. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the boat party.
All right. So you both have been talking a lot about this plan from essentially opposing viewpoints. So we're glad to get you both sitting at one table here today. And what I want to do for, because it's a fairly, you need to know some of the basic facts about what it is we're talking about. So before we begin to get to the part where we disagree, I just want to see if we agree on what it is we are talking about. So Mark, you'll be supporting the Build Back Better agenda. So can you lay out, take 2 minutes to lay out what it is the president has proposed? And don't argue for or against it at this point. Just describe it for us.
Yeah, the way that's broken down generally is into physical infrastructure spending. So, you know, roads, bridges, broadband, water, power grids, a range of physical infrastructure. And then social infrastructure. So that's, you know, everything from education, workforce development, to housing. We have a very severe shortage of affordable homes across the country, child care, elder care, paid family leave, health care, a range of various types of social investments. And the physical infrastructure, the social infrastructure, again, that includes both spending and various forms of tax cuts to provide those benefits to the economy. So that, in a nutshell, is what the president proposed earlier this year.
I want to take it over to Michael. Would you agree, Michael, we're talking about the same thing here?
I do, yeah. I think that's a very good summary.
And Michael, how would you rank this among spending visions, let me put it that way, in American history?
Well, it's huge. It's enormous. I think that it definitely stands out in the history of recent decades, for sure.
So, Mark Zandi, you are in support of, in general, of the plan and of this spending plan, this degree of spending and the goals of the spending. Make the case for it. Take a couple of minutes on that.
Sure. Well, I think most importantly, it is about lifting long-term economic growth. It's about ensuring that businesses have good infrastructure so that they can be competitive globally and expand and grow their business. It's about improving, therefore, productivity of the economy It's about increasing labor force participation, participation rates, particularly among women in lower income households, is low compared to many other parts of the world, in part because it's just very costly to work. Child care is very expensive, health care, elder care, that kind of thing. So first and foremost, it's a plan to improve the economy's long-term growth potential, which has been kind of stuck in the mud, since the financial crisis, and so to get it, back on track. And then secondly, it's about ensuring that the benefits of that increase in long-term economic growth accrue to lower income, lower middle income households, households that, have very clearly been left behind in our economy. The income and wealth distribution has become increasingly more skewed over the past three, four decades. And this is an effort to ensure that the benefits of the growth go to the groups that have been left behind. And then, finally, it's also addressing some very significant pernicious long-term problems. I mentioned the income and wealth distribution, but the other obvious issue is climate change, which I think, this is really starting to resonate with people given all the weather events, which are now it's increasingly easy to connect the dots back to climate change and the costs that are involved with that. And then the final thing I'll say is all of this is done in a way that's paid for, that there will be tax increases, effectively rolling back the Trump tax cuts, the tax cuts for large corporations, the tax cuts for the well-to-do, high-income, high-net-worth households. Roll those back, because those were massive in themselves back in 2018. Take that revenue and then use that, again, to help build out physical infrastructure, social infrastructure, lift long-term economic growth, and make sure the benefits of that growth go to low, middle-income households.
And before I take it over to Michael, Michael, a moment ago, was saying he does not consider the impact of the goods and services that would be bought with this money to be revolutionary. It's not New Deal like. It's not Lyndon Johnson Great Society like. It's not that ambitious. He called it a doubling down on existing programs. I'm wondering if you agree with that.
To a degree, but I view that as a feature, not a bug. We've got there's a lot of things going on here, and I think it's important to use the existing government infrastructure to make sure that we are able to execute in an effective way on all the things that are being proposed. But there are elements that are transformational. I think around climate change, for example, a lot of what's being proposed here is, it's a big deal and very transformational. It's moving the dial in a very big way.
All right, Michael Strain, your take now on the president's spending plan. You are a critic. What are the main points of your criticism?
In terms of the main points of my criticism, I think I would make three. One point relates to the kind of macroeconomic impact of this and the timing of it. The second point is more of a microeconomic point about the actual things that the president wants to spend money on. And then a third point is a process point. So on the first point, If Congress were to sign this into law, it would add $400 or $500 billion to the deficit over the next 2 years, and that would occur at a time when the demand side of the economy is going to be much stronger than the supply side. We have already seen several months of elevated consumer price inflation. We see household surveys of inflation expectations showing some troubling signs. Those haven't filtered into the bond market yet, but that could turn on a dime. So the big macroeconomic problem facing the economy right now is too much demand and too little supply. This would add to demand without adding to supply. I think Mark is right that there are some supply side effects that this program would have. I would expect those to kick in much later. So, you're talking about, for example, $500 billion or so in tax credits to households over the next 2 years. You're talking about over $100 billion of spending on social programs. This is going to fuel consumption at a time when consumer demand is arguably too strong. There will be tax increases associated with it as well, but those tax increases are simply not large enough to drown out the demand effects from the spending. So from a macroeconomic perspective, from a business cycle management perspective, this over the next 2 years would make our inflation problem worse. And it would reinforce the major problem that the economy faces, which is too much demand and too little supply, rather than mitigating it. Secondly, from a microeconomic perspective, you know, a lot of the spending, I think, is just very poorly designed. I share Mark's goal of improving the longer term growth prospects for the economy. I share Mark's goal of increasing economic opportunity, particularly for lower income households. And I think that there is a real role for the government to spend some money to advance those goals. A lot of what we're talking about here is really aimed at the middle class. Monthly checks to households with children that go to households making $250,000, $300,000 a year. You know, that's not gonna help boost long-term economic growth. It's not gonna help expand economic opportunity to lower-income households. My third criticism is a process criticism. We have seen, I think, from the Affordable Care Act and from the 2017 tax cuts, how important it is to policy stability for big, expensive, broad-reaching pieces of economic policy legislation to have at least some bipartisan support. If this were passed on a party line vote with only Democrats under the reconciliation process that exists in Congress, then all of these programs would be on substantially rocky ground. They would be very unstable. There would be big debates about wholesale repeal. And this uncertainty is bad for the economy. It makes it hard for people to plan. It would just be much, much better, I think, if there were some bipartisan support.
I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared U.S. More of our conversation when we return.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Welcome back to Intelligence Squared U.S. I'm your host, John Donvan. Let's return to our discussion. Okay, Michael, so we heard your 3 points and we heard the Mark's opening position. And there are several pieces of this to go through where the two of you, I think, are likely to remain in disagreement. Mark, I'm curious about, to get things started, Michael's concern about inflation, making the argument that, first of all, we have a population that has been not spending a whole lot of money for the past year. A lot of them have been saving that money. They're ready to spend that money. And he's arguing that a program at this time, just at the macroeconomic level, the fact that so many people are ready to spend and to throw so much more money into the system by an enormous scale has to be inflationary, and we would be paying that price in fairly short time. Can you take that on?
Yeah, sure. I'm not worried about inflation with regard to this legislation. I mean, we clearly have a problem with inflation in the here and now, but that's about the pandemic. You know, the economy is opening quickly, demand has surged, the supply side of the economy hasn't been able to keep up given the pandemic, global supply chains and, you know, people being sick and, you know, so forth and so on. That'll abate. And this legislation we're talking about now doesn't kick in until, you know, next year, and really not until 2023. So the inflationary issues we're facing today are independent of, in my view, the, you know, any concerns about the inflation with regard to this package.
All right, let me take that back to Michael.
I agree with Mark that a lot of the inflationary pressures we're seeing right now are due to reopening after the pandemic. They're due to households sitting on over $2 trillion of excess savings that they're able to spend. A lot of that is related to the pandemic. That's the demand side. On the supply side, there are a lot of pandemic-related reasons why the supply side of the economy isn't able to keep up with the demand side. But I don't expect those problems to disappear anytime soon. I think those problems are going to be with us in 2022. And possibly even in the 2023. And again, if you look at what the president is proposing, there would be hundreds of billions of dollars that would go into households' pockets in 2022, and hundreds of billions of dollars that would go into households' pockets in 2023. And the tax increases that the president is proposing simply wouldn't overwhelm that effect. The amount of money the president wants to raise in taxes is much less than the amount of money the president wants to give to households in 2022 and 2023. So I think that this would boost demand at a time when we have too much demand, and would not do anything to mitigate inflationary pressures, and in fact would exacerbate them.
Let me let Mark come back to that one more time. Go for it, Mark, please.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'd say bring it on. I mean, the unemployment rate is still 5.4%. That's way too high, and that doesn't include the millions of people who've stepped out of the workforce altogether because of the pandemic and are not counted as unemployed. So we still have a lot of what economists would call slack in the economy that we have to work through. And I'd say that there's nothing wrong with a strong economy. We want people to be fully employed. We want strong wage growth. We want to get back to that. And I think based on my arithmetic of the plan in looking through it, I don't get to a place where the economy, and Michael's, I think, concerned that it will overheat, that, you know, unemployment will get so low, that wage growth will be so strong, that inflation will become more of an endemic problem in the economy, could lead to higher interest rates and potentially lead to a recession, which obviously nobody wants. But I don't get there, you know, with the numbers that are here. In fact, I get to an economy that is at full employment with wage growth that's consistent with underlying productivity growth, but I'm not worried about it. I say let's get there, and if things are feeling a little hot, then the Federal Reserve can manage policy, and that's what the Federal Reserve does. That's what they did with the tax cuts that were implemented under President Trump. They had to navigate around that. They raised interest rates to try to cool things off. So a lot of what's being proposed here in the plan would address inflationary issues. So, for example, we all know that rents are rising very rapidly, and this is a big part of inflation, is because we have a very severe shortage of housing, particularly for lower priced homes and affordable rental. And a big part of what's being proposed here is to build more homes, to provide incentives, tax incentives, and other spending to increase the supply of housing to get rents down. So there are parts of the plan that would go to directly addressing any concerns about inflation.
Michael?
So there are two kind of distinct threats here. To the economy. One threat is the one that Mark outlined, which is, you know, consumers and businesses kind of change their expectations about the future path of inflation, and that those expectations become self-fulfilling, and the economy ends up in, you know, a kind of wage price spiral like we saw in the 1960s. In 1970s. I think that's a possibility. I probably think it's a stronger possibility than Mark does. But I don't expect that will happen, and that's not my main concern. My main concern instead is that the Federal Reserve decides that it needs to pump the brakes on the economy because it knows that any actions it takes today, you know, takes several months to really kick in. And so it's trying to figure out, you know, are we going to have inflation 6 months from now? Are we going to have inflation 9 months from now? Is it going to be troubling? What should we do today to react to what we think might happen in the future? And you know, the Fed decides that it wants to slow the economy, but not put it in reverse. And the Fed just isn't able to micromanage the economy with enough precision to execute that outcome. And so instead of slowing the economy, it does end up putting the economy in reverse. I think that is a very real risk that we face right now. If you look at household inflation expectations, they've risen considerably. They're near 5% at this point. If you look at the behavior of consumer and producer prices, you see worrying signs as well. And that's without another $3.5 trillion of government spending. So that I think is a very important distinction to make. The distinction between inflation being bad because it leads the Fed to accidentally cause a recession, and inflation being bad because we kind of repeat the 1960s.
Michael makes a good case, and economists have their views. I will point out that the collective wisdom in the financial markets is, no problem, don't worry, there's no inflationary issues. I mean, you can go take a look at the interest rates, 10-year treasury yields, for example, and you can tease out of that what the expectations are of investors. The global collective wisdom of investors about future inflation. And they're saying no problem. In fact, what they're saying now is inflation is exactly, precisely where you would want it to be, somewhere between 2 and 2.5%. And of course, these are people putting their money where their mouth is. They're buying bonds and they're looking out 10 years because these are 10-year investments. And they're saying, hey, and I know there's going to, I'm pricing in the very clear likelihood that we are going to get a big package from the president, that's, embedded in these expectations. But yet, don't worry. And of course, the bond market could be wrong too. Who's to know? But, the collective judgment is that, this is just about right. It's, right exactly down the strike zone in terms of where we want inflation to be.
Yeah, I agree with Mark about that. And I think it's important, to look at what the bond market is telling us. I would add that if you go back to last year, the bond market was expecting about 1.6% inflation over the next 5 years. Now the bond market is expecting about 2.4% inflation. So that's a substantial increase in just 1 year. And again, this is before another big fiscal policy package. And so the question, it's a question about what's going to happen in the future, which makes it really difficult. But the question is, if Congress does pass another big, big spending bill that is going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars over the next 2 years, what does that do to the outlook?
All right, I'm going to call an impasse on the question of inflation because you just clearly disagree, and I don't think you're going to persuade each other on that one. But I want to take a look at the matter of the timing of these proposed spending plans. And I take note of the fact, Michael, your most recent book is titled "The American Dream Is Not Dead," and you have an optimistic take on the economy and on the ability of people, certainly in the middle class, to prosper, not without, you're not in any way saying that things are perfect, by no means, but you're generally more optimistic than a lot of people. I'm curious, and I want to start with you, Mark, on this one. A large part of this of the proposed expenditures, for example, on climate change, child care, on education, they don't have anything to do with coming back from a pandemic necessarily. These same proposals could have been put on the table and argued for 2 years ago, 5 years ago. And so my question is this a situation where President Biden and his party are, as the saying goes, not letting a crisis go to waste and enacting changes to fix what they see as serious problems with the economy, some of which you outlined, for example, income and wealth inequality, the access to the workplace of of women and minorities, the weakness of unions, all sorts of things that the Democratic Party or certain wings of it have stood for a long time. Are they using this moment of crisis to push forward an agenda that they could have pushed forward if there were if there were not a pandemic?
No, I don't think this has anything to do with the pandemic. I think the American Rescue Plan, that was the $1.9 trillion package passed in March of this year. That's about the pandemic. That was about helping the economy navigate to the other side of the pandemic as gracefully as it possibly could. But this is about the future, the long-term future of the economy and addressing some of those long-term structural problems.
And I guess I'm asking why now? Why is it simply because there's a Democrat in the White House and there's Democrats control Congress?
Exactly. I mean, this would happen with or without the pandemic. I mean, you rarely get a situation where you have the presidency and the Congress in the hands of one party. And that's an opportunity to, you know, put forward your agenda, just like the Trump administration did, you know, back in 2016. They had the White House and the Congress, and they passed those large tax cuts. So I think this legislation would have been born, you know, regardless. And by the way, Michael made a really good point about bipartisanship and why that is more durable if you can have legislation that's bipartisan. Absolutely, positively agree with that. But I mean, here's the reality of it: that, you know, after that skinny down infrastructure bill that there's bipartisan support for, there is no possibility of any kind of agreement on a bipartisan way. And I will on the rest of the plan, the social infrastructure part of the plan in particular. And I would also argue that at the end of the day, good policy survives. If it's bad policy, like the Trump tax cuts, they don't survive because the next Congress is going to say, you know, I don't like that and we're going to do something about it. But if it's good policy, if people like it, if the American population thinks that that's the right thing to do, it will survive, you know, regardless. So,
well, but I've seen, Michael, you make the point that's not necessarily the case, that if these spending plans are enacted without any sort of meaningful Republican support, that the next time the Republicans get into the White House and control Congress, they're just going to cut this stuff back again. And I've seen you make that argument, and Mark is saying that's not true. If the policy is good, it's going to stick. So what's your take on that?
I'm worried about that. Yeah, I think there are a lot of factors involved, obviously. I mean, you know, President Obama famously kept in place the majority of the Bush tax cuts. The Affordable Care Act has survived multiple attempts by the Republican Party to repeal it. And so, you know, some of it depends on how long the president is in office. I think if President Obama hadn't won re-election to a second term, we probably wouldn't have an ACA. So will President Biden be re-elected in 2024? Is a big question. You know, my point is that it just creates an environment of massive uncertainty. And it makes it very difficult for households and businesses to plan. And I do think that if this were to pass, it would be target number one for the Republicans who are hoping to be president in 2024. And if one of them wins, I think it's very likely that a large share of what President Biden wants to do certainly could be repealed. It's not going to survive based on whether it's good policy. Some good policies will be repealed. Some bad policies will keep in place. It's going to be subject to a political process that is substance free to an unfortunately large degree. If, on the other hand, if this were done with bipartisan support, you know, then you're allowing a much more substantive process to shape the legislation in the first place, and so I think that. That does lead to better design policies that have longer staying power because they're better designed.
Let's talk a little bit about paying the bill. And Mark Zandi, you've pointed out that there are going to be tax increases, including very targeted, very explicitly, very much advertised tax increases on corporations, and on the wealthiest Americans. Is that because that's where the money is, or is that because it's a politically popular idea, or both?
Both, absolutely both. I mean, that's where the money is, obviously. I mean, lower middle-income households are struggling, particularly low-income households, but high-income households, high-net-worth households are doing very, very well, and that's where the money, and large corporations, you know, are doing very, very well. Corporate earnings are very strong, and that's where the money is. But it's good policy. You know, I think even if you roll back the Trump tax cuts to a significant degree, which is what's being proposed here to pay for the $4.5 trillion package, the negative consequences of that on the economy are on the margin. I mean, all else being equal, raising taxes are going to hurt the economy, but this is very much on the margin. And the reason why I say that is just the evidence. I mean, the tax cuts that were put into place in 2018, the Trump tax cuts, you know, if you go back and look, and there's now a number of academic studies that are coming forth on this, there was very inconsequential, very difficult to see, very hard to tease out any kind of economic benefit from those tax cuts. So, you know, logic would dictate, well, if it didn't really add to the economy, then it's not really going to hurt the economy, you know, rolling back those tax cuts. And the other thing I'd say is when we say rolling back, you know, even after you roll it back, the actual effective tax rate, what people are actually going to pay, high-income households, high-net-worth households are going to pay, what corporations are going to pay, is still very, very low by our long-run historical norms. You know, it's no higher than it has been on average since World War II. So, it, you know, it's where the money is, and I'd say it's a very good policy because it's being used to pay for, you know, policies that will have.
I guess I'm asking if it has a little bit of a populist overtone as well.
Well, it's yeah, sure. I mean, that makes sense, right? That goes to my other point that, you know, it will stick because it's popular. You know, people say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So, you know, and if people say it's, and that cuts across all political, you know, the popularity of doing this, of raising taxes on high income households, high big corporations is popular among many Democrats and many Republicans. And so I think that will stick.
I'm John Donvan. This is Intelligence Squared U.S. We'll hear more from our debaters right after this.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Intelligence Squared U.S. Let's get back to our debate. Let me take it over to Michael. The whole proposal to raise taxes on corporations and the wealthiest Americans, good idea or bad idea?
Well, I think it's a bad idea. I think it's a bad idea because there are better ways to raise revenue. You know, first of all, if we were to increase the tax rate that corporations pay,
Remind us of the numbers that we're talking about here.
The plan is to increase the corporate tax rate considerably from to do a full repeal of the Trump tax cut. I think what likely would end up happening is a corporate tax rate that would rise from 21% its current value to something like 28%. That seems like that's the kind of thing that the Democrats in the Senate could agree to. And then the plan is to increase the tax rates on capital gains. Kind of an increase of roughly the same magnitude as what could pass the Senate. And I think these are not the right way to raise this revenue. Take the corporate rate, for example. If you increase the corporate rate, you're going to reduce the wages of workers. And so President Biden's promise to not increase taxes on households making less than $400,000 a year is going to be violated.
Let me just stop you from a layman's perspective. Talk us through why increasing the corporate tax rate is going to decrease the wages of workers.
Increasing the corporate tax rate will reduce the amount of investment spending that businesses engage in. That will reduce productivity, and lower productivity will reduce the extent to which businesses compete in the labor market to attract and retain workers. Less competition in the labor market for workers will lower their wages.
I just want to take that for 14 seconds to Mark to see if that cause and effect that makes sense to Mark, or is that disputable?
In theory, right. In practice, it's inconsequential. It's very much on the margin. Second, third order kind of effects.
Okay, let me bring it back to Michael. Keep going, Michael.
The kind of consensus view among economists is, that workers will bear, 20%, 25% of the burden of a corporate tax increase. I wouldn't characterize that as inconsequential or as a second or third order effect. That's going to be felt by workers, and it's something that should be avoided. A higher corporate tax rate also makes the U.S. A less attractive place to do business in a world that's increasingly competitive. Having said all that, you need to raise money for spending, and so I do commend the president for trying to pay for this. The big glaring omission here is, where is the carbon tax? The president wants to enact policies to mitigate climate change. The president wants to raise revenue to pay for social programs and to pay for transfer payments to households. The carbon tax would do both. And a $40 a ton carbon tax, which is a kind of consensus place to start, that could generate enough money to pay for well over half of the president's entire $3.5 trillion spending proposal. And if we raised money by taxing pollution, we wouldn't have to raise taxes on corporations. We wouldn't have to raise taxes on savings. It's Econ 101. If you tax something, you get less of it. Do we want less corporate income? Do we want less savings? No and no. Do we want less pollution? The president does. Where's the carbon tax?
Well, I think there's widespread agreement among economists, and I'm right in there with Michael. I love the carbon tax. I think that's a great idea, but it's a political non-starter, very difficult to do. It would torpedo the president's total plan because he wouldn't be able to get that through even the Democratic Senate. But having said that, I would point out, interestingly enough, that in the, the president proposed this legislation earlier in the year, and now it's making its way through Congress. In the current legislative kind of incarnation of this plan, the thing that got passed by the Senate in reconciliation, the Democratic Senate, they have what they call a carbon border adjustment tax, which is kind of cool. It's kind of like a carbon tax, and the Europeans are also thinking about doing it, and they want the Americans to come along, us. So that it feels like politically we kind of sort of in moving in the right direction. Maybe not what I would do if I were king for the day, but if I were the advisor to the king, I'd say this seems pretty good to me. So we're moving in that direction. But I think the reason why I didn't make it into the President Biden's original proposal is just a political calculation. He wants to get this done. So what do I need to do to get this done?
Michael, speaking of that point of getting it done, there is a sense every time the president has talked about this since last January that at some point or other, particularly on an issue that has, I think broad consensus of the nature of the problem, climate change, that sooner or later something really big and something really expensive would have to be undertaken. And so now he's doing it. Do you think he's right that a big check needed to be written at some point? You may disagree with the details. I'm actually more talking about the bottom line, that this was going to have to be a great big expensive thing that was going to need federal leadership. And now now I'm doing it, he's saying. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of insight in Mark's comment that the president just wanted to get this done. I think that is shaping the climate provisions and the entire package. A way to get a better law would be to take a little more time and actually engage in some persuasion. there's a lot of stuff in here. The idea is just to kind of ram it through the system without it really being subject to scrutiny or debate. Climate policy, which was your question, is a great example of this. The best way to reduce carbon emissions in the United States is to enact a carbon tax, hands down. A carbon tax would do much more to fight climate change than the provisions that the president has put in the proposal. It would do more than weatherization. It would do more than electrification. It would do more than.
But it seems the reason he's setting things up in terms of, you know, winterizing houses and building out an infrastructure for recharging electric cars is that he's trying to simultaneously provide a lot of jobs. So it's kind of it's structured as a sort of double win. It'll address the economy and it'll also employ a lot of people. That seems to me to be the thinking in structuring it that way. I wonder, Mark, do you agree that's part of the thinking, and is Michael right that there would be more efficient ways to actually address climate than providing all of those jobs to all of those people? But providing all of those jobs to all of those people has its own benefit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think it's about more and better jobs because the economy will be at full employment. You know, we will have low unemployment. And so it's about making sure that the jobs we do have are the jobs of the future, that they pay well, and that they, you know, make sure that everyone's doing better than they have done before. They're better jobs. They're green jobs. They're not, you know, kind of mining jobs. These are higher quality jobs. I will say, though, you know, I think it's wrong to argue that these policies are like half-baked or haven't been thought through, that they're being rammed through. Not so, because I'm involved in some of the pieces of this, and I know exactly the process that's going in place, and it's a very, very careful process that's been in train for years. You know, these policies aren't, you know, just these have been policies that people have been working on for decades and thinking about them and, you know, trying them out in pilot projects at the state level and thinking through these things. So these are not things that are just, you know, being thrown, you know.
Well, I think what Michael's saying is being rammed through is the legislative process that, these things passing with one, you know, a tied vote broken by the vice president is not. That is almost by definition a ramming through, especially using the end run of reconciliation.
I hear you, John. But look, I mean, we're not going to get anything done. I mean, we tried this. President Obama tried that strategy, and after Obamacare, zero got done. Nothing got done after 2010. So, I mean, there's a lot of concern that, you know, if you engage in a process, that the process is going nowhere, and we got problems. We got climate change problems. We got problems with income and wealth distribution. We have got an economy that's not growing quickly enough. You know, so we need to act, and this is the time to act. So, you know, I hear you, and I'd love for that to be true, that, you know, with deliberate, you know, policy discussions that we're going to come to a conclusion that's going to be better. I don't believe that to be true. That's just not practical.
So, Michael, Mark just mentioned the other sort of big problem. And I want to take this to you again in light of your book talking about the American dream not being dead. Income and wealth inequality, which is truly at extremes, and particularly at the more deprived end of the extreme, affecting discrete groups, particularly minorities. And I want to ask you whether, like climate change, this is a problem that does have to be dealt with, that should be dealt with by the federal government, that should be dealt with through a spending program. What is your take on that?
I'm less concerned about inequality per se than I am concerned about helping people at the bottom, helping people who live in low income households and who need greater access to the opportunities that exist in our country. The president's doing some of that. The expansion in the earned income tax credit, for example, is a policy that will do that. But I don't think we should confuse the $3.5 trillion budget bill with a bill that is really designed to help provide a greater opportunity to lower income households. This bill will overwhelmingly benefit the middle class. If you look at the dollars that are being spent here, those dollars are going to go. The vast majority of those dollars are going to go to households that are well above the poverty line. Will some things help lower income households in here? Sure, yeah, absolutely, they will. In several instances, they're well designed and they should be commended. But this is the spending in this bill is much more targeted to the middle class than it is targeted to lower income households.
Yeah, well, I think it helps low and middle income households, and I think low income households, middle income households, you know, certainly need the help that they're struggling, have been struggling for for the past 3-4 decades. And that was brought into very clear relief during the pandemic itself, particularly folks in the bottom half of the distribution of income, and in most cases that part of the distribution has no wealth. They don't own stocks, and in most cases they don't own any homes, so they're very hard pressed, and they rely on government, particularly in times of crisis. So I think this plan goes a long way to addressing the income and wealth inequalities. Will it solve it? No, because it's a problem that's been entrained for 3-4 decades. It's not going to be solved by even a plan this large, but it's a good start in that direction. It's not a reason not to vote for this piece of legislation, just because it also helps out middle-income households.
Well, in terms of a vote for legislation, what do you both predict in terms of all of this ultimately going through? As you mentioned at the beginning, you've both mentioned that a narrower version of the infrastructure plan has been agreed on between the parties with a significant number of Republican votes. I guess people don't really disagree that we need the new roads and the bridges and the broadband, that part is less... less in dispute, but there is so much more that's more socially, as was described, the social benefit of these programs, such as free college education, support for childcare, strengthening unions, et cetera, to enhance the power of labor. Those things, I think, would be much more contentious. And I wanted to get your take on just a prediction on, and I'll start with you, Michael. Do you think that those things will ultimately become, that spending on those will ultimately become the law?
I think the odds of the $3.5 trillion budget proposal being signed into law are significantly less than 50-50. The question is, what will be signed into law? Because I think something ultimately will. And is that something that has $2 trillion of what the president wants, $1.5 trillion, $2.5 trillion? That I think is where the debate is going to be. But I think it's quite unlikely that he'll get that the president will get the full bill he wants.
What do you think the things he won't be able to get?
I think that remains to be seen. Right now, most of the debate in Washington has been about the top line figures. It's been about the macroeconomic impact that the bill will have. And there hasn't really been a debate about the details yet. And, I'm hoping that comes, because that's obviously a critical component.
Mark, same question to you. What do you see the president being able to get through, and his party being able to get through in this process?
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear Michael say that. It surprised me a little bit. I mean, because he's such a good observer of the Washington scene. So I take that with it's an important point. What I'm assuming, I do economic forecasting for a living, right? So I have to have very explicit assumptions around the fiscal policy and monetary policy. And I'm assuming that $3 trillion will get through. That would include both the infrastructure, the bipartisan infrastructure plan, that's the $550 billion that got bipartisan support, and that would also include an additional $2.5 trillion in social infrastructure, the kinds of things we've been talking about. So $3 trillion in total, and that it would be paid for over a 15-year period. I may have to rethink the odds I would put on passage, but before Michael opined on this, I would have said significantly above even odds that we'll get about a $3 trillion package.
Well, I like that as an indication of how much show of respect for one another and that you take one another so seriously. And as we wrap up, I want to thank you for taking on a topic that requires a lot of nuance. And economics is a tough subject for the lay audience, but I think that you made it quite understandable. There's a lot of unpredictable here. One is, what aspects of this plan will pass? And the second one that Michael brought up, if it passes and then the Republicans take over, does it all get undone again? We just don't know. And that is unpredictable. So much of this is unpredictable. But the two of you, Michael and Mark, gave us a little bit of a glimpse into the future that I think is useful and enlightening. And you did it in a way, as I said, that you showed respect for one another, and that's what we aim for in our competitive conversations at Intelligence Squared. So Michael Strain and Mark Zandi, thank you so much for joining us on Intelligence Squared, Agree to Disagree.
Thank you, John. Can I thank Michael, and can I say, I strive to be 51% right, so, just saying.
If you're 51% right, then you win.
Yeah, there you go. That's my point. Yeah.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care.
Thank you.
I want to thank you, our audience, for tuning into this episode of Intelligence Squared. I hope that you enjoyed it just as much as we did. Intelligence Squared is a nonprofit generously funded by listeners like you and by the Rosencrantz Foundation. Clea Connor is our CEO. David Ariosto is head of editorial. Amy Kraft is chief of staff and leads production. And Shay O'Mara is our consulting producer. Jen Zelmer is our senior researcher. Damon Whittemore is our radio producer. Robert Rosencrantz is our chairman. And I'm your host, John Donvan.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.